And you were saying that her husband died when he was 42?
Yes. I think his name was Frank Wise, I think. Died at the age of about 42, dropped dead quite suddenly, leaving her with a large house in Berkhamsted and four children, all of them, you know, still at school. And she had to go out to work. And she always used this illustration to persuade girls of the importance of having a career, even if they were dead set on marriage, which was very effective. And she managed to put them all through the university, and they all did quite well. And
so that was her main interest, her family?
Yes, her family were her main interest.
Yeah.
She also believed quite passionately that girls should be educated to be independent because of her own personal experience. I don't think she had much interest in the women's movement as such. And I think in some ways she faintly disapproved of Ray Strachey, which was understandable.
Well, not a normal mother with her husband around? And,
no.
You know,
And she retired after she became organizing secretary to marry again. She married a rather frail, elderly widower when they were both quite old, and was very happy for a number of years. I used to see them both. No, she was an awfully nice person, but unexceptional in a way.
Yes.
And Ray wasn't. And I think she just faintly, never said so, much too loyal to say such a thing. Mm. But I think she was faintly disapproving of Mrs. Strachey.
About feminism, do you think that from the beginning Ray had the idea of we're hiving off from the London Society?
Oh yes, I think she had.
I mean, it was only a sort of temporary expedient that she remained on the premises for
I think she wanted her own show, that she could, you know, run her own way.
Mm.
She wasn't somebody's lieutenant. I mean, she had to be the captain. She was that kind of person.
Because it is rather a cuckoo in a nest, isn't it, really? It was absorbing more and more rooms, wasn't it, as some of the papers
Yes, it was. And I think the London National were, in one sense, quite pleased to have us hive off. What Ray always said to me, and she said this on more than one occasion, is that we are fighting for the advancement of women and girls. We're not going to do this by in any way estranging the fathers. If we are known to be part and parcel of a political organization with a suffragist background, we will be doomed from the word go in some male eyes. Therefore, it's much better that we should sever these political affiliations.
Yes.
And just be a careers advisory concern.
And I imagine Pippa's response to that would be that this is one of the functions of the London Society, to create fruitful organisations.
I think Pippa entirely agreed with her, because Pippa was passionately interested in the work we were doing.
Mm.
Passionately interested.
Mm.
And saw, as Ray did, that the natural evolution of the suffrage movement was the education of girls to be independent.
Yes.
But it was no good just fighting for the vote unless you educated people how to use the vote.
Mm. Do you think actually that WEF was founded at a convenient time from the economic point of view? I mean, it's founded just at the uplift from the Depression, isn't it, really?
From the point of view of finance, I don't think in that kind of organisation any time would be a good time.
No.
I mean, people will give money to start off homes for the aged, for sick animals, for tired ponies, for the disabled. But who is going to give money to educate girls better? I mean,
yes.
Even now it's jolly difficult.
Mm.
Mothers leave their fortunes to their son's public school, which probably already has quite a lot. They don't leave it to their daughter's public school.
Yes, and in fact you got money from the Carnegie trustees and the Jubilee Fund, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes.
And that was done by clever negotiation.
We had several appeals,
yes.
which didn't bring in a great deal. One brought in 400. We had a vast Christmas fair. And somewhere I've got some photographs of that, if I could find them. I don't know where they are.
Yeah.
which Ethel Wood, who was a great friend of Ray Strachey's, you know, the Christian scientist, the one who wrote The Pilgrimage of Perseverance.
No, I haven't come across
that. Oh, Ethel Wood was a great character. A great eccentric, an impassioned Christian scientist and healer, and a keen feminist. She wrote a charming book called The Pilgrimage of Perseverance, which is the history of women in the abbeys, which I must lend to you if I can find it. Joan at the moment is cataloguing our joint books, and we're both hoping we'll both live long enough for her to complete the task, but I'm not sure. And Ethel Wood helped her mount this Christmas fair at Caxton Hall, and she also organised several conferences for her. She was on the executive committee for a time.
I see. Because another person who's around a lot is Molly Hamilton, isn't she?
Yes, indeed. Now, she's not alive, is she?
No.
I knew her. She and I represented WEF at these conferences with the Ministry of Labour prior to the drawing up of the Control of Engagement Order in 1944.
She was really just a sort of sympathetic woman with political experience.
Yes, she was a friend. She was definitely a friend of Ray's.
Yes.
They were on very
intimate
terms.
What did they have in common? Because, again, I don't think Barbara will mind me telling you that Barbara herself didn't like her at all.
A lot of people didn't like her.
What did Ray and Molly Hamilton have in common? Why did they get on well together? Because they did, isn't there that about it?
Well, again, I didn't know Mrs. Hamilton intimately. I worked with her a little. I met her frequently when we went to these meetings together. Can one ever say what people find?
I just wondered whether you could people. Sort of sense when you saw
she was
together
very attractive. She was a very attractive woman.
Well, she's a vital woman, was she? Or
vital, good-looking, attractive.
Progressive, of course.
Very progressive. An interesting turn of speech.
Mm.
She wrote charmingly about Ray when she died. Mm. Really charmingly.
Yes.
And in a way, I think, in a very few words, summed up some of the qualities.
Yes. No, in Remembering My Good Friends, I think it's a very good passage on Ray in her autobiography.
Yes. I wonder if I've got the obituary notice.
I've read her memoir of Ray, yes, which is...
No, it was an obituary notice that she wrote about
her. Oh, in
that
case, maybe I haven't.
I wonder if I've got it in a copy of the... I've done quite a bit of lecturing for them. For a time I belonged to them, then I lapsed.
I really wondered, they're just about starting up, aren't they?
Yes.
But here we're talking about this up to 1940, aren't they?
Because they were, you know, a self-advancement organisation, really.
Were they?
Yes. They were out to promote the interest of business and professional women.
Mm.
Whereas I think, certainly, in the joint placing pool, the register that we took over from the London and National Society, we were out to promote better opportunities for women. As you know, they refused to take onto the list any jobs that were less than 300 a year, which was considered a handsome salary in those days. Mm. But I think really that Ray had a much wider vision than that. She wasn't just concerned with getting more pay for women, getting women into the civil service, getting women into the professions. I think she was primarily concerned with helping women to realise themselves and their own potential.
Mm.
And she felt very strongly, and so do I, that all the legislation in the world is not going to do the slightest bit of good unless women come to terms with themselves as equal citizens and get away from this myth that you can't be a really first-rate professional woman and a really first-rate wife and homemaker and mother, because I think the best people do all things. It's not easy. But you might just as well say that you can't be a first-class professional man and a first-class father and husband, and yet a lot of people achieve it.
Yes.
The best of them do all things.
Yes.
The lesser fry do the best they can.
Yes.
But I think she was deeply concerned about this.
Yes.
Women's realization of themselves and their own potential.
Yes.
And I think that you know, it wasn't quite an Annie get your gun point of view, everything you can do, I can do better at all. Mm. But I think some of her hobbies, like building a house, were partly a demonstration at that time to show that women could do it.
Yes, and also immense physical energy, of course, which she just has to use up.
Yes, she had immense physical energy.
Yes.
But it's... it was more than that.
Yes.
Because, you know, she could have taken it out in playing
tennis,
squash,
or
tennis,
yes,
or anything of that kind.
But, the actual...
but I think she had to do something that women hadn't done.
Mm.
And I can understand this point of view, because when I was very small, I wanted to be a sailor, and didn't realise at all at that stage that being a girl, I couldn't be a sailor. And by the time I grew old enough, my father did have a small yacht, which he ran with his brother, but by the time I was old enough to take advantage of this, the family fortunes had waned, and there was no yacht. And then I decided I wanted to be a scientist. That was certainly my father's influence, because though he wasn't a scientist, he was passionately interested in all the new scientific developments at the turn of the century. And I think that, I'm not sure even now that it was the right choice for me, but I enjoyed it, which is the great thing. But certainly, when I was at school, my intention to be a scientist was helped by the fact that my headmistress so disapproved,
yes,
of girls going into science, particularly girls who wanted to dissect.
Well, I must tell you something about this.
A lot of pushing.
You pushed, did another. You?
Oh, yes.
How?
Well, we used to go and see things in operation and not miss an opportunity of saying, have you ever thought of, you know, employing a woman to do this?
Yes. And even in the early stage. The point is, that makes it rather political, doesn't it? As soon as you get involved in pushing in Parliament to open career.
Well, in a sense, we were political.
Yeah.
We were not party political.
Yes.
But we were political in that we were, in our own small way, trying to change the face of society.
Yes, yes.
I did an enormous amount of propaganda myself about occupational therapy to convince the medical profession this really was a career, not just something that any nurse could do.
Mm.
And we did this with everything. We encouraged girls to look wider than the traditional feminine roles, quite deliberately.
Yes, but there's a distinction between doing that, isn't there, and actually trying to legislatively break open a profession or campaign for equal pay, well, not equal pay, but equal opportunity. Legislation, if you see what I mean. I mean, isn't WEF really operating on individual girls through propaganda,
yes,
schools and so on?
It's quite true.
The London Society
but
operates.
WEF also supplied lots of information to societies and organisations that were being militant about it.
I see. Mm.
Numbers of girls who were interested, numbers of girls who were actually able to do these things.
Mm.
And we did a lot of what one might describe as personal propaganda amongst employers of various kinds.
Mm.
So that while we were never the spearhead of a political movement.
Mm. That's still the function of the London Society and other feminist organisations.
Yes, yes. Certainly, I don't think you could describe the National Advisory Centre, which is what WEF became now, as a feminist in any sense. It just advises girls and boys who want advice, but mostly girls because we're specialists in girls, about how to train for things and what to do and what the prospects are.
Yes.
But in
yes.
the early days, it was a good deal more militant than that. I mean,
yes.
it really was a propagandist organisation to open up new fields of work for women, to get better rates of pay for women. And we were very much bound up with the equal pay movement.
Mm. Were you?
Oh, yes. I represented WEF on the Society of Women Teachers, Miss Perotti's organisation.
Oh,
you've
yes.
met her.
Yes, yes.
And I went on deputations.
This was in the 50s, was it?
Yes,
oh, yes.
Right. Mm. And that definitely I did as a member of WEF.
Mm, did you?
Yes.
Yes.
Mrs. Strachey was on it too.
Mm.
And Philippa was representing the London and National, I was representing WEF.
But insofar as you are propagandist, you really are carrying on the work of the London Society.
Well, yes. Oh, definitely. I mean, the London Society was, after all, our parent.
Yes.
And everything it stood for, we accepted. But our method of approach was different.
Yes.
And the separation was not because of any difference of opinion about what needed to be done. It was a tactical thing.
Yes, it's growth, isn't it?
Yes, it's growth. It's growth. And also, it was diplomacy.
Yes.
I mean, an organisation that is fighting for better career opportunities for women is much better not associated with a political movement.
Yes, yes.
Partly or otherwise.
Getting back to your visits that you paid, I wondered quite whether, again, I'm only talking about the very early period, the whole business of keeping information up to date is really quite a business. I mean, how did you actually keep information up to date then? Because you've got to engage in continuous research programmes.
Well, we were. I mean, the first thing we did was to make friendly relationships with all the professional training bodies and to get ourselves put on their mailing lists and to get prior information about pending changes, and that worked. We then had a very elaborate system of files and constant reports and constant visits. And we were all doing it, you see. It wasn't one person's job to do the research. You did it in going round. You picked up information. Having picked up a bit of information, you followed it through and tracked it back to its source and found how important it was. Mm. And there, I think, you know, Mrs. Wise's training and mine, she was art, she was English, but we both had experience of research and research methods.
Mm.
Was useful to them. Mm. We knew how to find information.
But there's a continuous obsolescence going on, isn't there, in any organisation like this?
I mean, you're out of date almost as soon as you've gone to press. I mean, we publish a training memorandum still every 2 years. Well, the last edition, which was absolutely ahead of everybody else when it came out 2 years ago, is now out of date, and there's another one being done. Only we are not publishing this year because Ruth Miller, who is on our committee, is updating her Penguin for Boys for Girls.
Mm. Mm.
And so we're using that as a stopgap while we redo the whole of the last
year. But it's quite a conscious worry all the way through, continuous
changing. Everything's changing the whole time. Mind you, it changes much more rapidly now than it did in 1936. In 1936, a lot of the careers that we now talk about were really only just opening up. And they'd made their own constitutions and their rules and regulations, and they were going to stick to them for a bit. It was the Second World War that I think has produced this terrible state of chassis in the career world.
Yes. What was, broadly speaking, this was a very broad question. What do you think the effect on WEF was of the Second World War? It obviously involved it much more closely with government, didn't it? In that you were involved in being consulted.
We were involved with the Ministry of Labour, we were involved with the Ministry of Food, we were involved with the armed forces, quite heavily involved. I was more involved with them than anyone else.
Yes.
But I was involved as a member of WEF. And
if you look at how its permanent development was affected by the war, clearly a lot of temporary developments due to the war situation, but what permanent effect do you think the war had? It's very difficult to know, I suppose, isn't it? Does it broaden out its area of concern? Does it?
It certainly broadened out its area of concern because we stopped a lot of our ordinary activities when war broke out and devoted ourselves to helping recruit women into the war effort. And when we were bombed out of Marsham Street, we moved for a time to Bedford College, and we recruited a whole lot of voluntary workers who used to come in by the day, and we set up an information service with the assistance and blessing of the Ministry of Labour, with whom we were on very good terms, to advise women about what they could do and to advise them about how, when it was later on in the 40s, legislation, how the control of engagement order worked with regard to certain restricted professions, and to tell them how they could get into the war effort. And that was entirely voluntary work. They were not charged for those interviews at all. That was the famous occasion, only it didn't happen in Bedford College, when I told you about the Dowager Lady Nun Burnham upending herself in her directoire navy blue knickers, practically causing this poor feeble creature to have a heart attack, because she was then quite an elderly.
But if you look at WEF, say, in 1949, to take an arbitrary date, how does it differ from WEF in 1939? And how far is the difference?
It had a much bigger field of work. We were working then in far more schools. Our numbers had grown. We had got on very good terms with the various government departments. We were known to them as being, you know, less than kin but more than kind. We were helping the newly formed Careers Advisory Service by then. And in fact, WEF was asked, that was Mrs. Wise and myself, to run a course for which they paid us for the first Middlesex Youth Employment Officers, only they were then called, yes, they were called Youth Employment Officers, who were a very depressed set of people, all of whom had been running juvenile employment exchanges. And they were considered redundant and were being moved on to a new service and deeply resenting.
Let me reveal my ignorance. The Careers Advisory Service is what? A sort of careers advice in relation
to schools?
Oh,
it's the state. It's schools, yes. Yes, it's a state service. There's one in every now.
There's been an evolution from juvenile employment exchanges.
Yes,
has
to
all
this.
These juvenile sections.
Yes,
in
yes.
To that.
To this. Well, the thing was started at the time of the redundancies of a great many of the Juvenile Employment Exchange officials.
Yeah.
And in Middlesex, when it was starting up, I think we had 27 of these people. And we ran a course for them at the Guildhall, you know, in Westminster Parliament Square. Mm-hmm. And they began very depressed, hating losing their old jobs.
Why were they redundant? I'm not quite clear.
I can't tell you. I ought to know, but I don't.
This was sort of late 40s.
But they were, when I say redundant, they may not have been redundant in the service, but this new service had been envisaged. And what they picked out were the least senior, and I think in many cases the least effective, members of the labour exchanges from the juvenile departments to start the new service. It was a Cinderella, really.
I see, yes, yes.
And Mrs. Wise and I ran this course, and what we tried to do, and I hope we succeeded, in fact I know we did, was to make them feel that far from being put onto a new kind of work, which was less interesting and less important than they'd been doing before, they were starting something entirely new, which was tremendously exciting and would be likely to grow. And of course it did grow. The service to begin with was extremely patchy, because in some areas of the country it came under the labour exchanges, and in other areas of the country it came under the educational authority. It's now a unified service. But it's quite interesting that a lot of those people not only became individual members of the of our organisation, but that they passed the word on to their successors. And ever since those days, we've had what I think is a quite unique relationship. We are, in fact, on a government private list which enables the careers advisors to apply for grants and leave to come to our conferences.
I see. Because, you see, what you're conveying then is partly under the influence of the Second World War, that it might have happened anyway, you're evolving towards a situation of being an agency consulted by government.
Yes,
really,
indeed,
aren't you?
Yes, indeed.
Initially, you presumably weren't that.
No, not at all.
You had to acquire all this expertise.
Initially, we were the brainchild of a collection of eccentric women.
Yes.
Who wanted to do something quite new. And everyone thought, oh, you know, these suffragettes.
Yes. And the war forces you into contact with
government,
makes it new.
And I don't think that would ever have happened if there hadn't been that severance between the London and National Society and Weff in the early days.
No.
I really think that was what made it possible, and I think both Ray Strachey and Philippa Strachey foresaw that.
Yes, I see. Yes, yes. So in a way, you're almost sort of extension of government in part of your life.
Well, I'm sure government wouldn't like that said, but the fact remains that...
you provide information.
We provide information. We were, I don't know whether this is still happening, but it was happening until 3 years ago, we were frequently consulted by government departments. I mean, the Foreign Office was in touch with us. The Ministry of Labour was in touch with us. There was never any feeling.
Well, you're like universities. Universities are now much more in a way.
And another thing, and this I did, and I'm very glad. I only once fought my splendid executive committee on a point of policy, and that was when the service had really got going, and we held these annual conferences. I said I want to invite the careers advisors to come in. And they said, you're knocking nails in your own coffin because they're going to do the job we're doing. And I said, well, this is part of British history. Voluntary organisations start things and they then become statutory organisations. And who am I to want to depart from the trend? And they said, oh, it should be a foolish thing to do. And I said, I am quite sure we would gain much more than we would lose. Anyhow, I carried the day.
This is in the early 50s, is it? Yes. Or what, that sort of time?
Yes, that time. I carried the day, and I did something else. I said, now, because, you see, we were having representatives from the best girls' public schools, from the independent schools, from state schools, even some from technical high schools, a mixed batch of teachers, heads, representatives of colleges and universities, because they all came. And I said, I'm simply going to label people with their names. I'm not going to label people with any category. So for the first time, all these careers advisors, part of the local authority service, that had never got into the independent schools and had never been mixed up with the bigger educational movement, because some schools simply wouldn't have them in, some schools still won't, were all mixed up together in the one audience with the right to ask questions and talk to each other, and nobody knew who anybody else was. And it worked. And I think, in fact, I know this is true, because and some of the men began coming, and I had a group that I used to call my old boys, who came every year, and from being two it spread, and now the numbers are about equal. But several of them came to me and said, you know, you don't know what you've done for us, giving us the chance to hear these people speak who are tops in their own professions, and not just having to depend on handouts and things that we're told we must say, because we're deluged with printed information about things, and we never really get a picture of a career or a profession described by a really good speaker who is an outstanding success in it. And this is what we did. And we used to go to the very top, you know, and ask people like Kathleen Kenyon to come talk about archaeology. I knew a fair number of people, and I think I had or I'd learned something of Ray Strachey's method, that if you want to get service, go to the very top. They're the people who are most likely to help you for nothing, because we didn't pay any fees. And they did.
So actually, there's one, in a way, you would say then, would you, that the growth of careers advice by government, which in a sense is doing precisely what you want it done, has eroded the function of your organisation in the long term, has it? Or did it?
No, I don't think it has, because our organisation is a very small one. It's limited by money, it's limited by the staff it can afford to employ, it works in a rather small field, it's very highly respected in the small field in which it works, and it cooperates wherever it can with the larger statutory agencies, which is what I think is a good thing.
So does it deal with an area which the employment exchanges and careers advisory service in schools don't really touch?
Yes,
is that
I think it does. In that, because we're free, because nobody gives us any money at government level, we can say precisely what we think is likely to happen. We can afford to be wrong. Now, a local authority official speaking on behalf of his local authority may not be wrong. Therefore, they can only say what they are sure is true at the time at which they say it.
And they can't experiment.
And they can't give any kind of wild advice. They can't say to a collection of girls, if you want to be sea captains, why not, when you know there are only 12 at sea? Nor can they say, because nobody knows, that in 20 years' time there may be 200 at sea. Whereas we could say it's quite possible that in 20 years' time there may be 200. So we're the type of talk that the organisation gives on careers, and I'm afraid this is less so now than it was, because I don't mind sticking my neck out. And Miss Menon has a very civil service point of view and is afraid to stick her neck out. She's younger. I mean, it doesn't matter if I'm wrong. People can just say, oh, well, she's an old lady and she didn't know. But Caglioni is much younger, and in any case, she minds about always being, you know, right. I'm perfectly prepared to admit that I may be wrong about almost anything, but I claim the right to think what I think to the best of my ability and to say this is what I think.
Let me ask you about another relationship with another set of organisations, appointments committees of universities. Now, I imagine when you started off in 1936, the appointments committee in Oxford was a much less professional affair than it is now.
Yes, indeed it was. Hilda Bryant was in charge of it.
How far does that do you out of business?
Well, we have a representative of the Cambridge Appointments Board, and we have a representative of the Oxford Appointments Board on our committee. It doesn't really do us out of business. They use us quite a lot.
I see, yes.
And they often send people to us.
So in a way you're an arm of them.
We're an arm of them. They don't all belong, of course, but quite a lot do.
Can you sort of explain at all, maybe it's a difficult question, what have been the changes, if any, in your relationship with appointments committees, particularly Oxford and Cambridge appointments committees, while you've been in WEF? I mean, have they changed much? Because in a way they created you, didn't they?
Well, they helped to create us. They didn't create us. They were roped in, bullied in the early days. Yes. I wouldn't say they created us in any sense. The London and National Society created us.
Well, yes, but and, I mean, that letter of the time signed by the heads of the women's colleges.
Yes, but that was because Ray Strachey went round and bullied the lot of them into doing it.
Yes, but I mean, there's an integral connection from the start.
There was a very integral connection.
Yes. Now, have there been any significant changes?
Well, yes, I think that perhaps now I would say they are more useful to us than we are to them. And also, I think there's a less, because they're bigger, very well organised, and they have money behind them, lots of information, there's a much less personal contact. Though the connection between Oxford and Cambridge and the organisation has held, just as the connection between a few big firms and ourselves has held, like ICI and Marks and Spencer's and so on. A lot of the newer university appointments boards, I think, probably haven't heard of us and couldn't care less. And some of them are not being very effective. You must know well that in the world of university appointments boards, there's the good, the bad, and the indifferent.
Yes, my impression of the Oxford Appointments Committee is it's really a frightfully professional affair now.
Well, it's a very professional.
Computerised information, the Lord knows what else.
But that doesn't make them... I mean, I do think Oxford is very efficient, because things got some good people in. I think Cambridge is too. I don't think the computerisation makes things efficient at all. In fact, I think it can make them very inefficient.
But anyway, the general thing is that, in a way, the appointments committees in relation to WEF have increased in influence, really, is what you're saying. Have they? They've increased in power vis-à-vis WEF.
Well, I wouldn't say vis-à-vis. I would have said that they've gone on doing their thing, and we've gone on doing ours, and they're perhaps more different now.
Yes.
Where I think there is a change, which, of course, usedn't to happen at all, is that the university appointments committees are now sending representatives into the schools to talk to boys and girls.
Yes,
about,
doing really what you originally did.
Doing what we originally did. But even so, they're only talking to the people who are likely to go up to university. We are talking about the whole range of careers, you know, from being a woman astronaut to being a hairdresser.
Yes. Yes.
That's the real difference.
Yes. Yes.
That we're able to interest ourselves in the kind of careers that
university
the very also ran type yes. of schoolgirl will yes. go into.
Yes.
And we endeavour not to have any kind of snobbish attitude about this. We always say that what matters is not what you elect to do, because it takes all sorts to make a world, but that you train as well as possible for what you want to do, and you become really good at your job. You become a professional, whether you're a hairdresser or a dressmaker or a top-ranking physicist.
Presumably in your last 10 years or so, in the last 10 years or so, you must have noticed that employment exchanges and the whole state system of assignment to jobs, it shows an increasing concern with women.
Well, it does.
So that, in a way, a lot of potential air, in a sense, is being at least catered for elsewhere, if not removed from West's attention, by the growth of the state's machine in that respect.
Have you ever tried to seek advice at a Labour exchange?
No, I'm talking entirely theoretically.
Well, you mustn't quote me on this, but at one time, Mrs. Strachey, and later Mrs. Wise, sent me round as a guinea pig. And I visited a lot of Labour exchanges, looking for how to get in, how to register myself and get into the war effort. And my experiences were really unbelievable. They were, you know, they were like a comic turn. And the last one I did was up in Acton, and I went to register with my age group. That was towards the end of the war, when they were, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel in ages. Up I went, and I said, "Here I am." I gave my name, my address, and she said, "Are you any qualifications?" And I said, "Well, I've got a university degree." And she said, "Oh, well, don't know that that helps much. What can you do?" So I said, "Well, I'm an organising secretary." And she said, "Oh, what are your speeds?" So I said, "Well, I type with two fingers and I don't know shorthand." She said, "Well, you're not a secretary then. I put you down as a clerk." So I said, "Well, I'm not a clerk." And this went on. Now, this is really true. I'm not exaggerating one spot, truly. I wasn't trying to deceive the child. She was quite a young girl and interviewed me. I was really trying to help. I said, "No, I'm not a secretary in your sense of the term. I'm an administrator." She said, "Oh, you're a civil servant. Why didn't you tell me?" And I said, "No, I'm not a civil servant."
They're trying to fit you into categories all the time,
yes,
aren't they?
You see. She really didn't know. And in the end, I went down on that register in spite of all my efforts as a clerk who could do some responsible work, who had a little typing, who could cook and who could sew. And I really was registered as that.
So,
and about 3 weeks after that, I received, so somebody must have thought, "Well, this is wrong." I received an invitation to apply to be head of the Acton Fire Brigade, because I had, during the course of our conversation, mentioned, she said, Have you ever done any training that could be useful?" And I said, "Well, yes, I've done quite a lot of IRP training. I have, in fact, organised and run a local ARP squad in my own area, and I hold the firefighter certificate of the metropolitan area of London. I had trained as a firefighter." It was quite true. I'd done this just as the thing.
But it wasn't the most prominent of your qualifications.
It wasn't. Well, it hardly, I would have said, because any woman as a firefighter has serious physical disadvantages, even if you're, as I was then, strong and pretty tough. Anyhow, there it was. And I was asked to apply for this. Head of the Acton Fire Brigade.
So what you're really saying is that, almost inevitably, the state employment machine is bureaucratic and clumsy, and that it
yes.
doesn't in any sense erode the function of a consultative, individual sort of organisation that...
I think I'd put it in more general terms than that. I think what I would say is that the function of a statutory body working in a particular field is one thing. and that the function of a voluntary body working in the same field is different.
Yes.
And that is without prejudging what either do. Because the state service has improved out of all recognition since it was started. When it was first started, it was inconceivably bad. It is now extremely good in parts, not so good in other parts, and poor in some. But this is inevitably true of any statutory organisation, isn't it?
Mm.
Yes. A voluntary body works in a much narrower field and can't compass what the state compasses and shouldn't set out to try. But it can do certain things because it's free and uninhibited that the state can't do. And
yes.
This is why I believe, not only in this context, but in every context, in the need for cooperation between voluntary and statutory bodies.
Mm.
I mean, I think the people who see everything as desirable, see it as desirable to have everything statutory, are making a profound mistake.
Yes, well, they're losing the opportunity for experiment on the frontier. So
yes, and not only are they losing that, they're losing the ability to deal with every individual case as an individual case and not as something that's got to be pushed into a category.
Yes. One other thing that I wanted to ask you was really about Ray's use of the press, if any. I mean, clearly one would be involved very much with the press now, even television perhaps. Did she show any consciousness of the importance of that?
Yes,
indeed. Do you remember anything about
that? I can't put my hand on or remember any individual interviews she gave to reporters. But reporters came into the office, she never refused to talk to them. And this is something I learned from her. She used to say, if you get the press on your side, they'll treat you very well. If you refuse to cooperate with them, they'll treat you very badly.
Of course, you had that conference that was misreported.
Yes, that was the first,
helped,
you see. After that, we used to give information to the press about conferences. And I was always being wound up by reporters. Would you comment on this, that, or the other thing? And I would say, yes, I will, but you must report me faithfully, otherwise I never will again. And on the whole, I found them very decent. They didn't let me down.
Because one would expect Ray, as an American, or half-American, to be less sort of bottled up about the press than an English person would be. I mean, more prepared to utilise the press, more aware of its power.
I think she would utilise anything that she thought could be useful to her, and the press could.
Mm.
We used to get a very good press over lots of things we held, conferences and reports and so on.
Yes, because I think, I don't know if it was you or somebody said that Ray knew, I wonder if I'm mixing up Ray or Mrs. Hubbard, might be Mrs. Hubbard actually, she knew that in order to get into the press you had to have an event, so to speak,
yes.
Stage an event.
That's
in
right.
Some sense.
We used to stage events,
yes.
We staged conferences. We had one on women in scientific work, which got a very good press.
I mean, you notified.
And she knew
beforehand.
Alison Settle of The Observer. Do you remember Alison Settle of The Observer?
No, I don't actually.
Oh, she was very, very good. You know, one of the really...
Who was
Alison
she?
Alison Settle. She used to write... the women's page of The Observer, the women's articles,
see.
But it was journalism of a very high order.
Yes, I see.
Not women's page stuff at
yes.
all, really.
Yes. One other point I want to ask you was, what was Ray's response to the bombing? Because it was before she died, wasn't it? I mean, how did she cope with the situation presented by the bombing out of West?
We just got on with it. I mean, we just moved.
Mm.
I even conducted an interview in the furniture van, taking the stuff up from Marsham Street to Bedford College. I really did.
You don't remember her sort of in the forefront, sort of sweeping out rooms or clearing
no.
up stuff or anything?
No,
I mean,
I never remember her sweeping out rooms or clearing
yes.
up stuff. The rest of us did that sort of thing.
Yes.
Which was quite right.
Mm. I just wondered.
But she was very much there. She was not thrown by things. She just got on with it, and the rest of us got on with it. And
yes, because it might have been a key moment, you know, to illustrate her attitudes, I suppose, when the bomb drops, you know, that brings out relationships.
I can tell you one thing, and this was before she died. No, it wasn't. It was after she died, so it really doesn't apply what you're saying. But we had moved for a time into that convent owned by the Sacred Heart in Cavendish Square. We had
plenty of
accommodation there. The nuns lent it to us. They were evacuated.
Big place.
And we had all our windows blown out. Not a bomb in the building, but a blast. Mm. And for the best part of 3 weeks in the winter, we carried on in that office without heat and without water, and with the winds of heaven and the rain blowing in. We did eventually get the ARP people to put some temporary plastic stuff over the windows.
That was probably when John Lewis was bombed, was it? I mean,
yes,
John Lewis was very badly
that
bombed.
That was it. Yeah. And this carried on, you see. Yeah. We just went straight on. We never closed.
Could I raise with you that thing that I think I must have raised in a letter with you, this thing about cynicism? I was just really quoting, or reading Mary Agnes Hamilton's thing about Ray, yes, saying how incongruous it was that this idealistic woman could, an idealistic judge by everything she did, could speak in the way she spoke, which in a sort of rather earthy, realistic sort of way. I just really wondered whether that fitted with your observation of the way she spoke.
What did Molly Hamilton mean by an earthy, realistic
way? Well, I think she meant that
she could use bad language occasionally.
Yes. No, she wasn't meaning that. I think it was in the context of talking about the Bloomsbury Group, whose influence in England Molly Hamilton thought was disastrous. The cynicism, the effeteness, the lack of vigour, so to speak. Ray had this sort of rather cynical way of talking that they had, but in fact she wasn't one of them. That was really the point, I think, that Molly Hamilton was making.
You see, I never heard her speak like that, but then I wasn't connected with the Bloomsbury group.
Yes.
I didn't know the
Maybe
wolves.
You weren't operating at that level.
No.
Mm. It doesn't
I've heard her say, you know, oh, this woman's a bloody fool, or somebody else is a bloody fool, or isn't this exasperating, and so on. But I wouldn't have said she was cynical at all.
No.
I would say that a lot of her speech, if it could be described as cynical, it never struck me as cynical, was a sort of cover-up. She wasn't a person to wear her heart on her sleeve. I think she probably was a woman who felt very deep emotion about lots of things. But she wasn't going to go round with that emotion up like a placard. And I think, too, you know, she could treat triumph and disaster as twin impostors. I think she was wise in that way, that if something had to be done, you got on with it and you did it, however impossible it looked. You were permitted to curse a bit on the way when things were going wrong, but you were not deterred.
I suppose realistic.
I think she had enormous courage, you know. Enormous courage, really.
Yeah.
And the kind of mental persistence which carried her through.
Yes.
And often achieved what appeared to be the impossible, because really to start that organisation, to get money out of people, to get all these well-known names onto a sheet of paper.
You get that sense from those documents.
Yes. She'd write to them in a sort of chatty way. Some of them she knew well, but some she didn't know well at all. And there's one letter, I don't know whether you came across it, because I didn't find it last time I looked through, from the wife of a bishop, I think in Chichester or Colchester, saying that if she couldn't get a cook, she didn't believe in all this unemployment and she certainly wouldn't support the organisation. Did you not? No, well, it's somewhere, I must find it. It's the only one, and thank goodness it was preserved, because I shall quote that.
But, I mean, basically, she's realistic. I suppose that's the way to describe it. She's realistic in her assessment of situations, people, and no nonsense,
yes.
Really.
Well, she was a physically, tremendously vital person.
Yes.
I mean, there was a lot of her in every way. Physically, mentally, she had enormous ebullience while being quite quiet.
Yes. One last thing about her, one of the things that Barbara said to me was that, again, I think I mentioned this in a letter to you, that her sister Karen did psychology in a big way.
Yes, I met her.
And Ray didn't believe in it,
no,
really.
No.
And as I was saying, in some ways you're right in on psychology, aren't you? I mean, you're in an area where if psychology is any use to anybody, it's going to be useful there. Now, did that ever come up? I mean, I myself privately am rather sceptical about psychology generally. But I mean, did she...
Psychology is not an exact science.
No, I agree. But I mean, did that ever come up? Did she ever discuss this? Did she ever...
I knew her sister was a psychologist. Mm. I have heard her laugh at psychological judgments.
Mm.
But... you see, I think a great many of us who tend to laugh at psychological judgments, and I do, I can tell you some very funny stories about psychologists, nevertheless practice psychology intuitively.
Yes.
Because
yes.
What is psychology, really, but a pattern of intuitive thinking?
Oh, yes, it's an understanding of human beings.
It's an understanding of human beings.
Mm.
I have read a good deal of psychology. I'm quite interested in it, but like you, I regard it as very dangerous.
I mean,
I've seen disastrous things
and that sort of thing. You never went in for that, did you? Or did
no,
you?
We go in now for a form of testing, and Caliani is throwing it over because she wants to be in with what the boys are doing,
yeah.
Which is the ISCO tests, which is Alec Rogers' tests.
Yes.
I refuse to use them because, A, I don't think they're good.
Mm-hmm.
The only test I ever used, and still do use, I've had a letter this morning from a school asking me to come down and do some, is the Connolly Interest Test,
mm-hmm.
which I regard as perfectly safe and a very useful peg on which to hang a lot of information which doesn't depend on the test, in such a way that parents who are blinded by science will accept it.
Yes, I see. But I mean, in the early days, it was entirely individual interviews and correspondence.
Yes, never used anything
like
that. There was
no aptitude test
or
anything like that.
But now, for the last 10 years or so, we have been using Connolly tests, and I still use them. Not because I think that any aptitude or vocational test of this kind is the whole answer.
Mm.
Nor do I think in 999 cases out of 1,000, do they ever produce any information that a skillful interviewer, in collaboration with the people who teach a boy or girl and the parents and the child, wouldn't find out themselves?
Yes.
But I do think that there is a type of parent who, if you tell them the whole truth for 50p, will think it can't be any good. And if you charge them £15 and write out a long rigmarole of the kind that I can show you, because I've got a little case full of them that I've done.
Yes, it looks sort of professional.
And it's all, you know, arranged under headings,
yeah.
Personality,
yeah.
Interests, hobbies, test results, and then an explanation
yeah.
of them,
yeah,
followed up by 2 or 3 pages of sound common sense advice, they will accept it.
Yeah.
Therefore it has a use. So if people say, well, I would like to have my child tested, I test them.
Yes.
And so does the organisation. But Miss Madden said, oh, well, I think we should do the ones that the boys do, and then we can go into the boys' schools. And so she went and trained. But she herself says, well, this really is, you know, more value to industrialists to see if a boy or girl could put things into slots than it is for the kind of
yes.
work we're doing.
Which is never really your function.
Not a bit.
You never really believe
not
in
a
that.
Bit, you see. And all the Connolly test does, and it does this remarkably effectively, because I tested it out on guinea pigs of both sexes and all ages before we used it. It establishes, through a very lengthy, repeated questionnaire, priority of interests.
Mm.
And if you know what a person's priority of interest is, and you know their academic achievement from a school record,
yes.
you can advise them with some hope of success.
Mm.
And what is more important is if you say this child is good with people and shows remarkable aptitude for figures and you know, enjoys reading detective stories and working out puzzles. I think accountancy or the law would be very good careers for, especially accountancy. I'm taking a ridiculous example, you know what I mean.
Mm.
Father and mother will say, oh well, you know, I had her tested.
Mm.
And
yes.
it becomes gospel.
Yes.
And while I think this is
There's a certain amount of dishonesty with a good intention lying behind it, in a sense, isn't there? You don't
it's
believe
the
in
end
it,
but justifying the means.
Yes, it's Ray again, isn't it?
I don't really believe in the infallibility of any psychological test that's ever been invented.
No,
I think the two people who got nearest to something really important are the two Vernons from Reading, Dr. Vernon and Dr. Vernon, father and daughter, who worked out some very interesting psychological tests, which I think worked, but they weren't wholly satisfied with them, and they were rather ponderous anyhow, and they just
That's interesting. I just thought it might be interesting, just in view of Ray's sister doing that. But one positively last question is simply this. The junior counsel, did it have any relationship much with WEF in your first 4 years?
No. The junior counsel's relationship was entirely with the London and National Society, and it was a means of pulling in the younger element and giving them power and responsibility to run themselves.
Were you actually on it yourself?
I wasn't on it. Mm. I used to go to its meetings. I worked in the same building. I knew Kathleen Halpin quite well, and Marguerite Bye, and so on, and Mrs. Henderson. But I was an employee of WEF, and I was a member of the Fawcett Society, and that was enough. And I was too old to be really junior counsel.
But you see,
how old was I? I was...
You're about
in
the
my middle 30s,
aren't you? Miss Halpin, I think.
Well, I'm 74 now.
Yes.
1936, what would I be? 32.
Of course, Miss Halpin
years.
Had joined much earlier, so in
yes,
a sense she...
Yes,
yeah.
yes. Mm-hmm. She was one of the sort of top people in it.
Yes, she
She'd
was.
Been in it since she was much
quite
younger.
Right, yeah. But you see, if you read the Fawcett Society annual reports, they say how very useful the junior counsel is, because it contains a number of young members of a large range of professions.
Yes. Yes.
And when we want information about careers, all we have to do is just ask Miss Blogs or whatever
yes.
it is.
Well,
what
we,
she thinks.
We went on doing that. I mean,
we knew
these young professional women. And so we would ask them and check up with them. So there was a lot of exchange of information in that way. But we never actually used them. We went out ourselves and looked at things. And then if we had doubts about them, we'd say, well, look, let's ask Ethel Watts, because she was a member of it too, to come and talk to a conference about accountancy. And we'd get hold of people we knew in the junior council or outside who were young and who would come along. Later on, policy changed, and I can't tell you exactly when or how, but I think there's been a reversal now, and this again is probably just a question of who the person organising the conference happens to know, or who they happen to know who knows somebody else who would be useful. But I deliberately followed a policy of trying to get the known top people in professions to come and talk. And I was incredibly successful in doing this, in that they were endlessly kind.
Mm.
And partly, I think, they were kind because they felt that I had in the end succeeded Mrs. Strachey. They knew her by name, they knew the origin of the organisation.
Mm.
Many of them shared our views about things.
Also, presumably by that time you were beginning to have a few of your own babies, so to speak, who'd come, got up and were prepared to...
Yes, but I didn't, on the whole, go for the young people alone. I went for the top older people with perhaps a younger person on a panel to answer questions.
But the junior council wasn't in any sense formally represented on your committee in WEF?
No. The London and National Society was, of course.
Yes, it's purely informal.
Not the junior council as a junior council.
No. But it is very useful sometimes, isn't it? I found this with students myself. If you, in a way, more useful than an older, how does it differ from other organisations catering for careers, quite apart from the employment exchange and the appointment?
Well, for one thing, we're a non-profit-making organisation.
Yes.
And apart from the statutory ones, we're the only one that is.
Are you? And what about, I don't know about, what is CRAC? What is that?
CRAC is a hybrid body. Crack started out, it's got itself listed as a charity, though I've never quite seen how it did it, but it has. It was started out by a collection of young men who, with strong business instincts, and they founded a centre for research and advice in educational matters and in careers. And they have made for themselves an empire by inventing a method of classification of careers literature, which somehow they have induced the local authorities and a great many of the schools to take up. And they are producing a very expensive equipment to do this, which has to be renewed in enlarged intervals. So this is a big source of income.
I see, yes.
Now, because we hadn't got those facilities, and because we happened to feel, I at one time tried to adopt the crack classification just for convenience, because we belong to crack. And Joan Anderson, who is the publications officer and between these four walls much the brightest person that WEF has, she's a Cambridge graduate, she's a remarkable person and very good at her job, but she doesn't want responsibility or like responsibility, so she works in a comparatively humble capacity under Miss Mellon. I wanted her to take over after me, but she wouldn't. Mm-hmm. She refused point blank. Well, Joan, who is the prop and stay of the place, without her it would fall to bits, said, if you do not remove this idiotic system, I will walk out tomorrow. We always call her the Duchess, because she's very embarrassed. And she works for practically nothing. She's quite a rich woman, actually, and is a tremendous force. I would have done anything to keep her. Mm. So we catalogue things under plain alphabetical order. Agriculture goes under A.
Medicine, in the first place.
Yes. Mm. Medicine goes under M, and not under JAG, as the crack classification. Theirs is the most common...
There's some pseudo-scientism about their methods.
Well, any ordinary trained librarian that was brought up on modified Dewey thinks that it's crazy. Mm. It's an empire. But it's a very money-making empire. They've been awfully clever about it. Now, they run a lot of very good conferences. Mm. They put out a tremendous amount of good literature by employing good people to write their stuff for them. And they've got
the
money.
Well, they're presumably not just women, are they? I mean,
No.
Nor are you now, for that matter.
No, we're not either. But they started out. They're more... they do boys and girls equally. They started out more with boys and then went on to girls.
So if you look at women's employment, say, since 1935, from then till the present, what has the distinctive contribution of WEF been as compared with other organisations? And that's a huge question. That you can take an hour to answer that one. I mean, what would you say its role has been primarily? It's primarily, really, professional people, isn't it? Or at least that's how it originated.
That's how it originated. It isn't that now. Mm. You're asking me an awfully difficult question. I really ought to have notice of this. I'll tell you what I think is this is a personal point of view. Mm. You see, we've now got a very large measure of equality of opportunity for which we've fought. We've got it. Trainings for boys and girls are identical. Early school training is becoming much more like. Mm. I wouldn't say it's identical.
Sewing classes for boys and things.
Yes. Oh yes, but I wasn't just meaning that.
Yes.
I was meaning whole method of approach and co-education and so on.
Yes.
But the fact remains that the reaction of the average girl to choosing a profession and the reaction of the average boy, and I am speaking of average, to choosing a profession is subtly different. And in trying to advise them, I think it's awfully important to remember, whether you're advising a girl or whether you're advising a boy. And by that, I don't just mean that the girl is going to go off and get married, because a great many of the girls who go off and get married and have their families and drop out of a profession will come back to them.
Mm.
I mean that the priorities of the girl and the priorities of the boy are very often different.
Mm.
And unless you know girls well enough or know boys well enough to reckon with these priorities, I don't think you do them, give them the best service.
No.
And I would say that what WEF has done, partly because of the way it started, partly because of the people whom it's employed through the years, I think it understands the point of view of girls. It knows how to advise girls and women.
Mm.
And I think that a lot of the state agencies and quite a lot of the commercial agencies that are doing this are so drunk with the idea of equality that they have forgotten that equality doesn't mean sameness.
Mm. Mm.
And I think there is a difference. I mean, I'm all for equality, but if I'm talking to an audience of boys, which I have to do sometimes, I don't talk to them in exactly the same way that I talk to an audience of girls. And this is not conscious. I found myself doing it.
Mm. So in terms of sort of gross impact on the market, on the labour market, so to speak, you couldn't expect a voluntary organisation with private funds to look big, could you? I mean, it's not that sort of organisation.
No, I don't think we ever have. I don't think we've ever seen the possibility of looking big. We couldn't have done it except by becoming a very efficient commercial concern.
Or part of the state machine.
Well, what we did was cooperate with the state machine, and we certainly helped the state machine quite a lot.
Yes, so really you could say that part of its achievement, you shouldn't just look at WEF itself to see its achievement.
I think that it wouldn't be an unjust claim to say that WEF helped to alter the whole pattern of women's employment and women's prospects. And I think that it has done something which is much more important, and that is made a lot of young women from all sorts of different levels of society look at much wider horizons in making their choice.
Mm. And has fertilized or stimulated other agencies to also concern themselves with women's employment, like...
Well, I don't really think we're responsible for that. I think what you have to remember, which I'm sure you do, is that careers advice became a very profitable bandwagon, and therefore an awful lot of people were only too anxious to jump on it. It's trendy.
Yes. Mm.
And anything that's trendy may mean money.
Mm. Mm.
And bodies, and I'm not saying anything against them, like systems analysts and careers analysts and even crack, have jumped on this bandwagon in a big way. And the reputable bodies are doing quite good work, but they're businesses.
Yes.
We never were a business.
Yes.
We never set out to be a business. We never set out to make money.
Mm.
If we ended up with a balance of a pound and not in the red, we thought we'd done a good job, you see.
Well, let's switch
and
off.
That way, terribly. I mean, it was like the McDonald's and the Campbell's. I mean, if I had said that I was going to a meeting run by anyone connected with the militants, you know, I would have been considered a traitor.
What, in the early years?
Yes.
When?
Well, 1936.
Would you really?
I would have been considered a traitor. And I think the fact that made me persona grata with Philippa was the fact that my parents, you know, belonged to the Constitution movement, not the militants, that my father disapproved of the militants.
But, I mean, neither Pippa nor Ray were sectarian people, in a way, were they? I mean, they
were very sectarian about the suffrage movement.
Were they really?
Oh, yes, Pippa certainly was. The militants, you didn't talk about the militants. You went to lay a wreath, you know, on Mrs. Fawcett's tablet in the Abbey once a year, but if I had said that I was also going to lay a wreath at Mrs. Pankhurst's statue in Parliament Gardens, I really would have been considered a black leg.
But you see, in 1929...
In a way, I think it was... I think the thing was kept up artificially.
Yes.
And possibly, this is pure surmise, the London and National Society felt that so much publicity had been given to the militants and none at all to them, that this was a way of redressing the balance. You know, you belong to one camp or the other. You didn't treat with both.
It's very interesting. But do you think the women's movement in any sense suffered between the wars through the existence of this division? Or was it stimulating?
I don't think it suffered, because on all deputations which concerned the welfare of women, like equal pay, equal opportunity and so on, there were everlasting deputations, you'd get representatives of both camps. And they would join for that, but they didn't celebrate each other in any way.
Did Ray and Piffer actually talk a lot about the suffrage period to you, or to complain about this misinterpretation to you much? And do you remember?
No. I can't remember hearing them talk about it at all. They talked incessantly about equal opportunity, and incessantly about the need to encourage women to realize themselves. But I'm sure you know Betty Friedman's book, don't you?
Yes.
Well, it's sensational, of course, but I do think it's important in that I think she stated for the first time what is the biggest handicap to the progress of women. Women do have this feeling of guilt.
Yes.
And whether it's just induced by society attitudes and will change, as I think society attitudes are changing already. In fact, I see a change since the passing of that last act, some of which I think is ridiculous. I see a very big change in general opinion about what girls can do.
Yes, because that's something that's been going on all through your
life. Yes, it has, but this, you know, it's been a sort of catalyst, really.
I do hope this is a catalyst to your own...
She opened the welfare.
It's on now.
The children's welfare, you know, in the Middlesbrough, the Red Cross Centre, and of course the suffragette work, and all of that, and that was a different person. But at home, she wasn't domesticated. She never washed my clothes or darned my socks or ironed anything or anything like that. But somehow, you could go, when I was a little girl, you could go and sit on her knee and feel as though you'd come home. And,
So she wasn't such a sort of dignified figure as she seemed in public.
No.
At home,
she was a totally human sort of person. She absolutely loved us, the children.
What about sort of discipline? I mean, that's something both of you, I suppose, must be involved
with.
Yes,
there was a certain discipline with her. You see, we had a nurse and a governess, and she didn't have that sort of association with her, with us. She got them always to see that we did the right thing. And I was a little in awe of her at night time, at 5 o'clock at night, after we'd had tea. We'd go down to the drawing room, I've told you this, haven't I? And she'd be there, and that was where we'd see her. And she'd have finished with the business of the day, the council meetings and all this sort of thing. And she'd be at home, and it was a gorgeous hour we had with her and with Daddy, and he'd go putting us on his back and romping around the drawing room with us, and we'd see her, and then...
That's when you were children, really?
Yes, and then we'd go to bed. The nurse would immediately take over. And so... But that hour was the highlight of our day. It wasn't a case of, oh, we must go and see her duty. It was the one thing we wanted to do because she was such a lovable person, in spite of her remoteness during the day.
She could sort of unbend, could she, with the children?
Yes, she could. And yet, when she had her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren round her, she used to find them, if they were rough and noisy, perhaps it was because of her age, wasn't it?
Well, perhaps it was, but to say with Justine... Because Justine answered
back. She would forgive Justine, anything.
And she didn't mind that, whereas perhaps the other children and grandchildren, they're a little bit more diffident towards her.
Yes, I see. She liked spirit, did she?
Yes, that's it, I'm sure.
Yes. And that's really why she liked seeing the clergyman, because she had a good argument or a good talk.
Yes, she did. Yes. And you probably know a little bit about my relationship.
Well, I know she was very fond of you.
Marriage. I was divorced.
Yes.
And then I had met somebody else who is very wonderful. And for a little while, she wasn't prepared to see him. She didn't like the breakup and everything being upset in the family. Everything ought to be organised in her mind. She got too old for anything to worry her. And she wasn't prepared to meet him. And I was determined that she was going to meet him. And so, against instructions, I took him along to the home about a year before she died. It was only about a year before. And I went in and left him with the matron. And I said that I'd brought him. And she said, all right, I'll see him. And he came in and he talked with her, had a long talk. And he won her over. But she said, all right, she said, I'll accept you. I don't approve of you. I don't approve of what you've done. But I like you. And so the pact was there. This constant disapproval of the fact that he was still married. But she liked him very, very much. And she knew
was
that
she always as direct as that?
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Oh, absolutely straight like that.
Yes, always direct. Mm. And at that age, and a year before she died, she said, I don't approve of it, but I like you. And from then on, he used to rub her knees, her rheumatic knees, and rub her around the shoulders, and play the piano to the people in the home. And she was terrifically proud of him, but she was always very firm that she didn't approve.
Was she actually quite strict? I suppose she was just like the rest of her generation,
yes,
being quite strict about that sort of thing. Conventional, if you might say.
I should say she was like the rest of her generation. Mm. Although there were times when she herself must have been unconventional, because I have a photograph somewhere here. I've not found it. In fact, I won't bother to find it, but I can tell you. Mm. It's of a number of young people on a boat in the Broads, men and women, young, I should say they were in their 20s, teens to 20s, when she was at college. And they had a holiday together on the boat in the Broads, boys and young men.
I think a lot of them were very unconventional.
And she was one of those.
Yeah.
And she was the prettiest of the lot in the There's no doubt about it. I mean, I'm quite sure that no man could have resisted her.
She met your father. Your father was much older than she was, wasn't he?
Yes.
She met him actually at a
suffrage meeting.
Her.
Oh, it's a lovely, it's a beautiful picture. Mm,
lovely.
Yeah.
I adored that one. That was just.
Was she actually, I mean,
she
was a really good-looking woman, really, as you remember her, pretty well all the way through, was she?
Well, strangely enough, to me, to the very moment when she died, she was beautiful.
Mm.
I always thought that of her, no matter whether she rubbed me up the wrong way, because I always had a terrific respect for her. There was no feeling I criticised her in lots and lots of ways, but there was always this feeling that you couldn't directly say to her anything unkind.
Mm.
You had this feeling of great respect for her. My father set her on a pedestal.
Did he really? Yes.
I think I seem to remember that. I think I seem to remember your sister saying that. And in fact, he must have seen her sort of on a platform, I suppose, first. At the Gisborough, wasn't it? Really?
I think so. Where we used to go around. Do you remember it, Paula? We used to go round the near the Abbey at Gisborough, and there's a place where they had public speaking in those days. She told me that always that she remembered being pelted with rotten eggs and tomatoes, soft tomatoes.
Oh yes, she spoke up against Churchill.
Did she really?
Yes,
when he
yes.
was a liberal.
Yes,
and I think that was round about the time when he met her.
That's right. Yes,
and this was. This was when she looked, that was when she looked like this. Where is it? That's how she looked then.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that must have been about the same time,
yeah.
hasn't it?
Yes.
So So did she talk a lot about her suffrage period in the family, or was that something that you knew about but didn't really talk about?
Oh, we talked about it. We knew about it. I was terribly proud of it, always. I still am. It's as though it was somebody not belonging to me, somebody far, far superior than my level of existence. In that part of her, I was very much superior. She was a very good speaker.
Mm.
And in those days, of course, she had a great deal of backing, being a woman. Yeah. Nowadays, of course, a woman, I suppose, wouldn't shine quite so much doing the things she did, because so many other women...
Yes, absolutely. She was unusual in those days, yes.
And that she was a pioneer.
Mm.
There was my mother's a politician, councillor, magistrate, and everything else. There was my mother as the person who organised the house by remote control. She
not
didn't
definitely by remote control.
Yes.
Not directly.
She did not do any housework. She didn't do any cooking. She always had somebody to do it, even when my father was suffering very badly financially. There was always somebody to clean the house, and in this way I would criticise her, but never to her face. One couldn't. You would look at her, you just wouldn't be able to say anything like that. Mm-hmm. Because she was who she was.
When you say she didn't do a lot in the house, or didn't do anything in the house, was that because she'd just always been used to servants from the beginning? The very beginning.
Yes, it was.
She had a sort of unusual upbringing, though, didn't she? She was brought up by an uncle and aunt.
Yes.
Actually, you probably know more about it than I do.
No, I don't. But I mean, I knew that, and presumably the uncle and aunt had servants as well.
Yes.
So I mean, in a way, she'd have been all through her life with servants, wouldn't she?
And she had the only thing that really jarred with me was the fact that she did talk about them as servants. They were, in spite of her being a socialist, they were a different class in society. And this is the strange thing about her, that she was a socialist. She was a woman who did so much for other people, but she definitely kept them as a different class.
How, actually? How was it done?
They had rules, and they didn't come in and chat with us. I know when I had anyone to clean the house, I would run round the place cleaning up well before she came. Do you remember Mrs. Underwood coming? And I would clean the place very well before she came to clean it. But
you worked
mother
together, really, in a way, with
yes,
your
yes,
help,
that's
whereas
so
she would leave them entirely alone.
Entirely. And
yes,
there was the kitchen, and they lived in the kitchen. This was a hangover of Victorian times, I suppose. And they lived in the kitchen, and they had their meals there. They were the upstairs-downstairs people, you see, in those days.
Well, it's odd, really, is because of her socialist
yes,
beliefs, in
yes,
a way, I suppose, isn't
and
it?
And the nurse.
She wouldn't have been able to do all the things that she wanted to do if she hadn't got a little bit of wealth behind her. It's because she had that, and perhaps that's because she had that attitude. She was able to do these things.
Yes, yes. She was very much a sort of leader locally, wasn't she? I mean, presumably they looked up to her, even the socialists, and were led
by
her.
And we've got pictures of garden parties where she would have these garden parties, and she'd be there, and people would come and almost pay homage to her and shake her hand, you know. And, everybody looked up to her. She really revelled in that sort of adulation. But she deserved it with them.
Because she'd done so much
yes,
for the party. Yes.
Yes.
Yes, my point was, you see, that in a way there's not so much a contradiction, because just as she's got her servants underneath her at home, she's really rather the boss in the local Labour Party as well,
that's
isn't
true,
she? I mean,
yes,
you know,
yes,
in both
yes,
spheres,
she chairman,
she's rather on
yes,
top, you see. I mean,
she was chairman of the local Labour Party
yes,
for many, many years.
presumably a grand old lady sort of thing towards
yes,
the end.
Yes, you've probably seen the picture of her, the presentation when she left to go and live in Derby.
Yes, I saw that, and there were all sorts of anniversary brochures.
Yes, I think I've got one, you've probably got a copy of it. This is it?
That's right, Honor, yes, your sister sent it to me.
You have that?
Yes, yes. But, I mean, when you say she liked the adulation, how did you know that she did? I mean, did she talk about these occasions a lot, or was it just an obvious zest when she was going out to one of these occasions?
No, perhaps I didn't realise it until a lot later on in life.
Mm.
Perhaps after I'd left home and been living in a very, very different manner, I probably began to sum her up differently. At home, as a child, she was just everything. She was just a goddess, you know, absolutely wonderful, and I never criticised at any time. It's when I left home and I saw how many other women had perhaps risen to being members of parliament and this sort of thing, but they'd worked a lot at home and they'd worked and brought their children up and done as much perhaps as she had, but without this sort of gracious lady. That she was so much the gracious lady, and she managed to carry it off so wonderfully.
Did she really?
Yes. Does that sort of explain a little bit?
Yes, it does.
That
yes. I mean, obviously
it was after I left home and not before.
I mean, that is part of the business of growing up in a way, isn't it? Getting away from home and then getting your parents into some sort of perspective and sort of saying, oh, well, you know, not everybody behaves as they did. They were unusual and this, that and the other way. And then you gradually get to a different relationship.
But then whenever I've in any way perhaps criticised her upside-down socialism, as it was at times, I've also thought how precious she was when I was ill at any time as a child. Then nobody could look after me except herself. She wouldn't delegate it to anybody at all. She'd spend days, I remember sometimes being really ill, as children often are, and she'd sit by my bed for hours reading to me, and she'd go downstairs and she'd get always the favourite things that she knew I liked. Bananas with the cream mashed on, I remember, and things like that, you know. And she would go to endless lengths then. So
how does that fit with her not being practical in domestic things? I mean, she could do the things that...
It doesn't fit, does it? This is where she just didn't. She had so obviously two sides, and you know that when you knew her, she would love to sit and talk for hours, but she would not do anything in her own home or anywhere domestically. It was as though she had a block there.
I wish I had that block. I would quite enjoy it.
Because you could. But you really feel then, I mean, she could have presumably done all these things. I mean, she could sew, could she? She could cook. I mean, maybe
one memorable... Well,
I don't think she ever cooked, did she?
I don't remember her cooking.
No, I don't remember. I remember I used to go over...
She told me that when she was first married, she cooked a chicken. She and Daddy couldn't have been vegetarian then.
No.
She cooked a chicken for my father's mother at Christmas, or chicken or something. And she put pounds and pounds of butter on it. I always heard this tale, and I can't visualise her cooking anything like that, you see. And one memorable occasion, she made a dress for my sister. And it was something so absolutely unusual, the fact that she sewed and made a dress, that I remember it. Whereas I made dresses and dresses and dresses for my children, and you as well, but she made this one dress. And we all thought it was wonderful, and she went up in our estimation. We loved her more because she'd made one dress, you see.
She must have had an unusual childhood upbringing herself.
Yes, do you know anything about that? I mean, what do you know about that, then, Ollie? She lived alone, didn't she, with this uncle and aunt. And I remember her saying, just before she died, when I saw her, that she had dogs or something. She used to take the dogs out.
No, I didn't know about that.
And we couldn't quite find out. Understand what she was getting at, but
She always had a way with animals.
Did she? You always had animals.
Yes, we always had animals. Mm. And animals always went to her.
In the photographs.
Dogs and cats, they always went to her. And she was incredibly soft with them. She loved them. So many people say, push a cat away or something like that, or a dog away, but she'd be delighted, wouldn't she, that they would go to her. And I think you and I have somewhat inherited this sort of
Well, is that because she's...
Animals,
and animals like people who sort of stay in the same place and don't jump about and run about. Was it because she was a stable figure that they... The animals knew she'd sort of sit still and cats would sit on.
That could have been. But she did love animals. Mm. That was one thing she did. She had an infinite capacity for loving.
Did she?
She thoroughly disapproved of smoking. I remember very clearly she saying one day, the men, her uncle and the men, used to smoke in the evenings, and she would come down into the drawing room, sitting room, whatever it was called, and the smell would be so stale. And that's why she disapproves of smoking, because of the smell.
Yes. Mm. Yes. And her father...
He was a gambler.
Yes, he was a gambler and he drank.
Did he really?
And he had gout. Mm. He was still alive when she was living with her uncle.
But her mother had died, presumably.
No, her mother didn't die till I was 2 or 3. He died earlier.
I once asked her about this, and she said, it was always easier to bring up boys than girls. This is why she went to live.
Yes, she had her brothers. And her uncle had no children, and he wanted her. And then, he married, her aunt died, and he married again, and she was never very happy with his second wife. I do remember this. Her telling me this.
But you think she went from her father because they were short of money, or?
I don't think
there was ever any shortage of money. There's always been this. I get teased about it so much about the middle class, a sort of middle class aura about her, and my father, of course, Craig, came right up from the working class, but she always appeared to be very, very much of the middle class, so I think she must have been right from the very earliest days.
She certainly had a middle class upbringing with the way she was educated.
Surely, yes.
And she, for a while, she was a teacher, wasn't she?
Yes, she was, Did she talk then much about her childhood? Presumably not, if neither of you know a lot about it.
No, she would talk about the days when they always made her May Queen, because her birthday was May the 3rd, and she was always May Queen. That must have been because she was must have been a very pretty child. Mm. She said too that she used to have golden hair, and she has said she was a pretty child. Very proudly she said this. And I think her uncle used to love to take her and show her off because she was pretty. And they used to make her sing, too, when he took her out. And in fact, she sang rather sweetly. She played the piano and sang.
I don't think I ever heard her sing.
No. She used often to play the piano and sing to us as children in that hour at 5 o'clock at night time. And when my aunt, that one, who was an alderman, you've seen the photograph somewhere here.
Mrs. Coates Hanson,
the aunt who was married to him.
Yes.
When they had their silver wedding at the Royal Hotel at Whitby one Christmas, my Uncle Walter's wife was an opera singer, and she was singing to the assembled company in what seemed to me then to be a big hall, maybe smaller if I saw it now, but then it seemed very big. And then there was a sort of silence, and then we heard a very, very sweet soprano voice coming across the hall after Aunt Eleanor had finished singing. And it was the carrying on of the song, and I couldn't tell you what it was. But I suddenly realised it was my mother sitting there, and she got everybody spellbound. And oh, the pride! She was my mother doing this. I was so proud of her. And I don't think anyone had expected her to.
Oh.
It wasn't anything flamboyant about her. It was just something, one of her talents, that she could do. And I think had she been given the opportunity, she would have been very talented. I've got her...
She has the usual of accomplishments, doesn't she, of a woman at that class level.
I've got her autograph album here, which might be of interest. Saturday, we're meeting Marion and Stan in York.
Nice.
That they can take us around, and they are going to show us the place where they've discovered that he was born.
Oh, that's splendid.
His father was a Quaker, and there was no money, no money at all there. And Daddy, I believe, was cleaning offices at the age of 10.
Was he really?
And all his education was night study.